Okay, beautiful. Here we are. So now we are actually starting a new Chumash today. Amazing. Chumash Bamidbar. Because last week we said we finished, we did what we would do in Pirchu Kaisai, and now we are starting Chumash Bamidbar. The truth is that we will go back to our old way of doing the Chumash properly, you know, more every single pasuk, but not with this parsha. What I'd like to do is, for sure, Parshas Bamidbar is more overview, a few psukim inside, and more general, because it is quite a technical parsha. It's a lot of counting. That's what it is, the counting of the Jewish people, and then the setting up of the way they camped, which we'll do next week. And the Mirtz Hashem, when we come back next year, we'll decide which parsha will start. Maybe it'll be, I might do selections from Parshas Nasai, and then go into Parshas Bahalaischa, but whichever one, we'll do all the important, and then we'll get into there's a lot of very nice stories also in Chumash Bamidbar, which will be very fascinating, and we'll do that, as we say, much more according to the order, you know, properly that way. But for today, what we'll do is we will read a few of the first psukim. So 1 minute, and I'll share the screen. I just want to see one thing, just make sure just make my sound higher. Okay, let me just share the screen and then we will start. Sorry. Okay. If you have a chumash, you're very welcome to take out a chumash Bamidbar, but we have the sheets in front of us, so we'll go right in order from the copies. Okay, so chumash Bamidbar is the fourth chumash of the Torah following chumash Vayikra. Chumash Mice is where the Jewish people went into Egypt, and then they came out of Egypt, and we had the story of the giving of the Torah, and we had the story of the Jewish people sinning at the golden calf, which was after the giving of the Torah, as we know, that was all the first year. After they sinned with the golden calf, Hashem forgave them, and he told them that they could build the Mishkan. That was all the first year from when they left Mitzrayim, all that. Then, so let's say they left Egypt in Nisan, in the month of Nisan. So after a full year of them leaving Egypt, they set up the Mishkan. And now what was supposed to happen was they were supposed to just do the final touches of how they were, you know, arranging the Mishkan. And then they were supposed to go into the land of Israel. That was what was supposed to happen. So in the month of Nisan is when they set up the Mishkan. And then in the month of Iyar, which is where we are going to start here, which is the second month of the year, of the second year from when they left Egypt, is where we are at the beginning of Chumash Bamidbar. So to put it all in context again, what we have now is all of the Jewish people who have left Egypt, the ones who survived after the sin of the golden calf, and now they had just had a few beautiful months of building the Mishkan, which was a beautiful, after they had been forgiven, building the Mishkan, knowing that Hashem promised he's going to rest his Shechina in the Mishkan. So it was very exciting, a lot of anticipation. They set up the Mishkan, and we know that when they were setting up the Mishkan, every single day, that was at the end of the first year, in the month of Adar, every day, Moshe Rabbeinu put up the Mishkan, Hashem's Shechina didn't come down, and then he would dismantle it. Right? He did that for a week, until finally on Rosh Chodesh Nisan, he set it up, and Hashem's Shechina finally revealed itself. So the Jewish people knew that they had been totally forgiven. Hashem was going to rest amongst them, and they were thrilled. It was a real high. And here, and that first month is like when we, a human being, moves into a new place. So we say that the first month is the settling time, right? You have to settle in, unpack, know where everything goes. That after a month, it's your permanent home. That's when you start making a mess, right? So the first month, you're careful. But the point is, the first month, it's temporary. The second month is when it's considered your permanent dwelling. So too with Hashem in the Mishkan, after the first month, so after the first month of Nisan, when we come to the second month, here we have where Hashem is permanently dwelling in the Mishkan. And now the Jewish people really have to know exactly where their position is, what they should be doing, and exactly how to treat everything and actually put it into practice. And this is the context with which we start our Chumash Bamidbar. So looking in Pasuk Aleph, so it says like this, Vayedabra Hashem al Moshe b'midbar Sinai. Hashem spoke to Moshe, and every word here is quite exact, in the Midbar Sinai, in the desert of Sinai. Where was it? Specifically, Be'ohel Mayed, in the tent of meeting, which we know is another name for the Mishkan, the Ohel Mayed. Be'echad Lachaydesh, on the first day of the month of which month? L'chodesh Hasheni of the second month, which is the month of Iyar. Bashana Hashenis, in the second year, Litseisa Me'eretz Mitzrayim, from when they left Egypt, Lamar saying. I'll just read one more pasuk and then we'll come back. Let's see what's happening. What does he say? He says, Hashem says to Moshe Rabbeinu, Se'u esroish kol adas b'nei Yisrael. And here they translate, take a census. So count. Count the entire assembly of the Jewish people, lemishpachaisam, according to their families, leveis avaisam, according to their father's house, bimispar shemais, very specific, by the number of names. So you sort of write down each name. So it's not just a general, it's a very, very specific counting. And you also have to identify each person. And then it goes on the next page. We're going to come back, sorry, to Rashi. But kol zohar l'gulgulaysam, every male according to their head count. So now we're going to qualify a little more exactly who's being counted. And we'll see why it's specifically this group. Mi ben esrim shana v'mayla, right? This is pasuk gimel, from 20 years. This is on the second page. From 20 years, pasuk gimel, from 20 years of age and up. Why? And it says clearly in the pasuk, kol yoytze tzava, everyone who goes out to the army. So these are the men who will fight from the age of 20 till the age of 60. Be Yisrael, amongst the Jewish people, tifgidu aysam, you shall count them, litziv aysam, according to their armies, ata v'aharein. Who does the counting? Moshe and Aharein. This is interesting. We'll see soon why it's interesting. This is not the first time they've been counted, but this is the first time that Moshe seems to need an assistant. Aaron helps him with the counting. And who else counts? Not only Moshe and Aaron, v'itchem yihiyu, and with you, with Moshe and Aaron should be, ish ish lemate, ish roish levesa vesavu, which means one man from each tribe, a man, which man? A man who is a prince of his father's house. In other words, what we know as the Nasi. The prince, the Nasi of each tribe. Every tribe had a specific designated person who was designated as the Nasi of the tribe, and they helped Moshe Rabbeinu count their tribe. So that made it a lot simpler to get the job done. I mean, this is a massive job. And we're not going to read the next few psukim, go through the names. I'll just read one. You'll see it says, Ve'ela Shmoisa Anashim, so it goes through all the names, Asher Yamdu Itchem, who will stand with you. And it goes, Reuven Elitzur Ben Shedeir, Shimon Shlumuel Ben Surishadai, Yehuda Nachshain, famous Nachshain Ben Aminadav, we know he was the one that jumped into the sea first, Liyisachar Nisan El Betzuar, he was also very famous, he gave the idea of specifically to bring the Karbanis on the day of the inauguration, all these very great holy men, Lezvulun Eliyav ben Chaylan, Levnei Yosef, and we see in Yosef, actually they divided them into two, Ephraim and Menashe, so Ephraim Elishama ben Amihud, Menashe Gamliel ben Pedatzor, Binyamin Avidam ben Gedoini, Ledon Achiezer ben Amishadai. So it goes through all of the different tribes and exactly the names of the prince. Sorry to make you crazy. Go back to the first page. Sorry, Ron. I know I make everybody mishuga. Go to the first page, and we want to see the first Rashi. Because first, let's take apart a little bit what's happening. So far what we see is that they've arrived. I mean, they haven't arrived now. They've arrived there a long time ago, a whole year ago almost, 11 months ago practically. They arrived in Midbar Sinai, in the desert of Sinai. But here they're being commanded that Moshe and Aaron will count them. So Rashi, Be'echad L'chodesh. So Rashi says, "Vayidaber b'midbar Sinai be'echad l'chodesh." Hashem spoke in the wilderness of Sinai on the first of the second month. Why? Why do we have to count them? What's the question? So let me explain something. The Jewish people have been counted a very short time ago. Actually, only 6 months before, 6 to 7 months. When the Jewish people did the sin of the golden calf, we know many of them died, right? They died in the plague, the ones who committed the sin. And then afterwards, Hashem forgave them. And when was the forgiveness officially complete? Was on Yom Kippur, when Moshe Rabbeinu came down from the mountain. After that, Hashem told Moshe that he should count the Jewish people. Why? To know how many unfortunately passed away and how many were left. So there was a census done then. Now, 7 months later, Hashem is telling Moshe to count the Jewish people again. Why? Why recount them? What's the point? Okay, so Rashi says, why recount them? Mitaychi basan lefanav. Because of Israel's dearness before him. So in other words, because Hashem loves us. Mayna oisam, he counts them kol shah, at all times. Kishe yatsu mitzrayim, when they departed from Egypt, he counted them in Na'am. Interesting, it says, why did he count them when they left Egypt? Actually, that was a beautiful counting. That was to show them the miracle. Because when they went down to Egypt, how many were they? Do you remember? Like mamish nothing, 70 exactly, very small. A little family of 70 almost could fit into this room. A small family, that's what they were. When they left Egypt, they were 600,000 men. I mean, it was a crazy difference that happened. It was an amazing, amazing, and that was only in 210 years. So Hashem wanted to show them that despite the difficulty that they had had in Egypt, and sometimes we say because of it, they grew so much, right? So that was that counting. So there was the count. So in a sense, really, that here Rashi calls that the first, but really that's the second counting, because the first counting is when they went into Egypt, second counting when they left Egypt. And then it says, ukishenaflu be'egel, when they fell at the sin of the golden calf, minon, he counted them. Why? Leida minyan ha'naisrim, as we know, to know the number of who remained. Ukisheba lahashrei shchinase aleihem, now when he's coming to rest his presence on them. So here Rashi gives us a little bit of a clue as far as why he would count them here. So he counted them. Why? So he says, and why here? Because on the first day of Nisan, Hukam HaMishkan, the tabernacle was built, was erected. And then comes Be'echad Be'iyar, this is the 1 month later, on the first of the month of Iyar, Minam, he counted them. So according to Rashi, all we see is that Hashem wants to rest his Shechina, and this counting is obviously a sign of love. There is love. Why does counting have to do with love? So there's a few, I mean, we all know this is a very famous thing, but there's a few beautiful analogies given in the Medrash that if somebody has, I don't know, a whole pile of straw, I mean, he's not going to stand there and count them. But if somebody has a pile of jewels and they come home, even if they're exhausted at night, they, before they go to sleep, they sit there and they count each jewel. And it gives them pleasure. That's the way it is. So that's why Rashi says, because he loves us, he counts us. So the counting is interesting. It's a sign of the love. But what's fascinating is that even though it's just a sign of the love, the actual counting increases the love. Because when you count, you actually notice each one. And when you notice, that brings out the love even more. The connection is even stronger. So it's an interesting thing how you're motivated because of the love, and it actually increases the love. Now, we know there is a downside to counting, as we always talk about, that we don't count people. The downside of counting is, because let's say, for example, with that example of the jewels, if somebody has a pile of diamonds and they sit there and they take each diamond individually out of the pile, what could happen as they're looking at each one? What's a possibility that could happen? What might they notice?
A fault.
Exactly right. A fault. You might see one diamond that has a fault in it. That won't be so exciting, right? That the poor diamond, Nebuch, will be put on the bottom of the pile, right? So counting has an incredible, like, a greatness to it, and it shows love, and you feel love because you matter. And yet, there's also the downside. Because sometimes you want to blend in. You don't necessarily want everybody to look at you with a big microscope and notice every detail and say, hmm. So that's a fascinating thing with counting. And that's why, to avoid that, we know what Torah does. What Torah does is it says, don't count them by head. Rather, we know the way Torah counts. The famous thing was the machtsa shekel, right? Right, so you give, oh, by two, that's interesting. But also, no, you give like something like towards tzedakah, right? You give them money, you count, and you count the coin. So instead of counting the person, you count the coin, which was the person gave. The idea being, interesting, there's a few ideas with it, but one of them is you're sort of shifting it from yourself, but also because you're giving tzedakah, so that already elevates you. So your flaws are not so noticeable. And that's a beautiful thing. Because when a person does a kindness and reaches out and does something for somebody else, then you don't look at them with the same way. You don't notice the negativity. All you notice is the positive. So therefore, that's in a sense almost a preventative measure of taking away whatever's negative from the counting. So as we know, that's a very general thing. We're going to come to a few of the mefarshim here, more specific of what they did here. And there is a big question, actually, whether here they counted with a coin or not. It's not so clear. According to some commentaries, they actually counted the people as people. Some commentaries say that. According to some, it says no, that they counted them also with a tzedakah. Okay, but we'll come back to that in a minute. I wanted to see. Okay, let's just do a few more of the Rashis, and then we're going to come into some of the beautiful mefarshim. Lemishpachaisam. Why according to their family? So he says, Leida minyan kol shevet v'shevet, to know the number of each tribe, because part of this counting was for the army. They were going to be going into the land of Israel, and they needed to set up their army. That was the idea. So that's why they counted the men from the age 20 to 60. But it was also because they had to set up how they were camping, how they were traveling. Their, so to speak, how do you say it? Their, the arrangement of exactly where everybody would be. And for that, they needed to know exactly the number of the tribe and who belonged to which tribe, so that everybody would be where they're meant to be. What is Levesa Vaisam? So he says, Misha Aviv. Now, very interesting. According to the house of their father, it's fascinating. We know that in Yiddishkeit, that the lineage goes according to the mother. If the mother's Jewish, you're Jewish. But the tribe goes according to the father. Right, so if the father's a Kayin, you're a Kayin. If the father's a Levi, you're a Levi. That's what we know nowadays. But in those days, they knew exactly which tribe they were from. So it's interesting, that's what he says over here. One whose father was from one tribe, the imay mishevet achar, and the mother was from another, yakum al shevet aviv, will take his stand. In other words, will be counted with the tribe of his father. And we know that they camped in their tribes. And that's why it was important to identify which tribe you belong to. Okay, one more quick Rashi here. Legul Galoisam, it's a key word. So here you see Rashi's opinion. What is Legul Galoisam? Literally, Legul Galoisam means the head. So that would sound like they counted each head. But Rashi says, Al Yidei Shkolim, by means of counting Shkolim. So according to Rashi, they also gave a shekel, beka lagulgoilas, a half a shekel per head, even by this count. That's Rashi's opinion. And then we know, what is kol yoytzei tzava, everyone who goes out to the army, magid she'en yoytzei b'tzava, mi pachais mi ben esrim. You don't go out to war under the age of 20. And then he says, as we mentioned before, who's with him? Moshe, Aaron, and the Nasi. Just a very quick thing. Why Aaron didn't help him in the last count? Because I'll just tell you something fascinating, that even though there had been 7 months since the previous count, the actual total, we won't get to the total today, but the total was exactly the same. Could you imagine counting of people, and 7 months, there shouldn't be one person who passed away. The total is the same. It's incredible. It's a miracle. It's mamish a miracle. The fascinating thing is that by the first count, after the Egel, Aaron didn't participate. Only Moshe. Why? It makes sense. Unfortunately, we remember when we learned about the Chet HaEgel, who helped the Jewish people make the calf? It was Aaron. So it didn't make sense that the one who helped them make the calf, so to speak, who had a little bit of part, should be counting the people who are left, the people who survived. People would look at it a little bit negatively, like he had a part and now he's looking at who's left over, so it wouldn't be good. So there Aaron had to step aside. But over here, when we're talking about they're setting up the Mishkan and Hashem is dwelling amongst them, who plays one of the biggest roles is Aaron HaKayin, and therefore it made sense for Aaron to be there helping Moshe with the count. There's another very beautiful thing that it says, is that when we talk about Moshe and Aaron counting the Jewish people, it's explained very beautifully, and it actually is explained more deeply with the counting of the tribe of Levi, who wasn't in this general count, by the way. This is not including the Shevet Levi, because these are the people who go out to war, so it's not Levi. But when we come to the tribe of Levi, it actually says very beautifully that they counted them from age month, a month old. And Moshe and Aaron would go to the tent, and like a voice would come out saying, how many? Imagine a census that you have, an automatic voice saying how many members of the family there are. But the idea was also, but the people would stand there and people would be seen by Moshe and Aaron. And it explains a very beautiful thing, that it's like even nowadays, many people have a custom, or if they can, you like to go before a tzaddik. The people wanted Moshe and Aaron to see them, to count them, because Moshe and Aaron had the power to bring down blessing for every single individual, and every individual here represented their family, thereby blessing their family. And this was part of the idea why it was both the two great tzaddikim, Moshe and Aaron, together, giving this tremendous blessing as they were counting the Jewish people. Okay, but we mentioned an interesting miracle. In the 7 months, the count totals the same. Why? So there's two explanations. Either it was a miracle, or we can give a simple logical explanation. It says like this, that when they did the counting, they did the counting by age. So anybody who turned 20 that year was counted, right? So if you turned 20, for example, after Tishrei till the next Tishrei, that was the way it was counted. So therefore, since this is in the same year, you counted everybody from the age of 20 till the age of 60, right? So anybody who was over the age of 60 or turned 60 in those 7 months, so to speak, anybody who turned 61 would still be counted. They're 60 in that year. Or anybody who was 19 and turned 20 wouldn't be counted anymore in the second count, unless they were already counted in the first count. So that's why we don't have a problem with saying, but didn't people turn 20 in the middle? But no, because if you didn't turn 20 before Tishrei, you weren't in either of the senses. But it says like this, a very beautiful thing. What about people passing away? So it explains that since the Jewish people were involved in building the Mishkan, they were doing a mitzvah, and they were involved in such a holy task, therefore, Hashem made a miracle and nobody passed away. They had a special level of blessing, so nobody died in that time. And that's why it's true, the number actually remained exactly the same. Now, I'm going to show you something really quite beautiful here. Let's see, before we go to the next one. Something very nice. And then we'll come back to our beautiful psukim here. Sorry, 1 second. So now we read in the pasuk, we said there were many, many words that were very, very, very exact. I know I feel I should go exactly in order, but I'm just going to read one beautiful thing, and then we'll come back to the first pasuk. So in pasuk beis, it said to count. Oh, by the way, very important thing also is that the whole Chumash Bamidbar, we know it as Bamidbar, which means in the desert, and we will discuss the desert in a minute because that's a very important part. But there's another name for the Chumash, and that's called Chumash Pikudim, the book of counting, numbers. In English, that's why it's called numbers. It's actually called Chumash HaPikudim, the Chumash of counting. They're counted in this parasha, and they're counted later on in parashas Pinchas as well. What's the significance? That's what we have to understand. Two very big themes that run through, the concept of desert and the concept of counting. Now, if you just look right away here, it uses the language for counting. It doesn't say Yifkoid, it says it later, but here it just says Si'u. What is the word Si'u? So we translate it as take a census, but the truth is that the word Si'u means to lift, and it says to lift the heads of the entire congregation of Bnei Yisrael. What does this mean, to raise the head? So it says a beautiful thing, that in this is the concept that's also connected to the idea of the desert, that this, even though, we'll see in a minute, we'll do a Ramban, which gives us a very beautiful introduction, even though this Chumash deals mainly with things which are temporary, so to speak, things which happened at that point in history, and doesn't give us many mitzvahs which apply for later generations, so it seems like, what's the point? It's a very important, fundamental Chumash, which shows us, in a sense, almost our journey in life. That's what it is. And a lot of our life, we journey through what we might call a desert. And what we have to do in order to go through the desert, the first thing is we need the se'u es rosh, the elevating of the head. But who does that for us? So it says, first of all, Moshe and Aaron on behalf of Hashem. So Hashem lifts our head. But we, every single morning, when we wake up, we have to activate it. So Hashem does it for us, but we have to activate it. And I'll just show you, that's why in Shulchan Aruch, when you, it's at the third page in the booklet, in Shulchan Aruch, when you open up, what's the first halacha? The first halacha is that when a person wakes up in the morning, how should you wake up? You know what it is? That's it, Maida'ani. But even more, what are you saying? I know how we wake up. Sometimes we snooze, and want to stay in bed a little longer. It's raining, it's cold, snuggle up. But actually, Shulchan Aruch is a very exact way of waking up. It says, we learn, I'll just read one or two, I'll very quickly. It says, Yehuda ben Tema Aymer, Yehuda ben Tema teaches us, Heve oz kanomer, be bold, as we say, bold as a leopard, and light as an eagle, right? And swift as a deer, and strong as a lion. Why all these things? And what does it mean? To do the will of Hashem. So he says a very beautiful thing. What does it mean to be bold as a leopard? So that's a very important ingredient. The first thing in the morning is shaloi lehisbayesh mipnei bnei adam hamalikim. Not to allow ourselves to be shamed, not to allow ourselves to feel less than when people mock us, when people put us down. And what we mean here very specifically is when people say you have made a choice in life that instead of Monday morning you can go, I don't know, do whatever you like, you come to a shir, you spend time learning, you daven, you do things which sound so, you know, some people would say wasting your time. We say no, we have the chutzpah, we have the confidence to feel that we are doing the right thing. We don't feel ever, ever, ever put down. We feel confident. We are not embarrassed. And then we say that we are strong as a lion, which is the strength in the heart, in order to overcome any enemy that tries to overcome us. And that could be our enemy within. And that's why it says, we put here a pasuk that David HaMelech said, he didn't wait for the dawn. He woke up the dawn. He woke up before dawn. In other words, because he was strong as a lion. I want to show you one. That's what he says over here. So, what does this mean, Gibor Ka'ari, and as we said, Oz Kanamer? So we say like this. This is the idea of Se'u Es Reish. Se'u Es Reish means that Hashem gives us that ability to lift our heads. You know, sometimes when you look at somebody and their head is up, sometimes you look at it as arrogance. Arrogance is not a good thing. We know. But every trait has a positive side. A person has to have confidence. They have to be assertive. They have to be strong in what they believe. And that's a good arrogance. That's U.S. Reich. That's lifting our heads so that we can feel confident and strong in what we are doing, and what we are doing is correct. And that's why Chumash Bamidbar, immediately, that's the first thing. It starts. Okay, so now, just going to go now down. If you want to, you can go to your fourth page of your booklet. I'll do a few. This one is a very important Ramban. This is an introductory Ramban. The Ramban gives us an introduction to understand, to put into context, what's Chumash Bamidbar? Okay, so it has a number one near it, the Ramban. Yeah, that's right, perfect. That's it, thrown a perfect page. Okay, beautiful. So it is number one here. It says, Achar Shebir Teres HaKarbanis. After we've explained the whole idea of Karbanis, B'Sefer HaShlishi in the third book, which is Chumash Vayikra, Hischil Ata L'Sadr B'Sefer HaZen. Now it begins to organize, to set out for us in this book, HaMitzvah Shenitztavu B'Inyan Ohel Moed, all of the mitzvahs which we were exactly commanded regarding the Mishkan, so how to implement them. And he says, Ukvar Hizir Al Tumas Mikdash V'Kadoshav L'Dairis, we've already been told, we've already been warned and explained the whole concept in Chumash Vayikra about the impurity of the Mishkan and how to treat it for generations, the holiness, the sanctity for generations. But now, Ata Yagbiles HaMishkan, but now we're actually implementing and we're putting all the borders around the Mishkan. B'Yosai Bamidbar, as the Mishkan is going to travel through the desert. And the Ramban tells us a beautiful thing. There is a model here. It's a very interesting pattern. The Mishkan travels with them in the desert and they treat it with a holiness. But the truth is, this is not the first time. This is actually the second time. The first time is, as we say here, Kasher Higbil Har Sinai, Bihiyois HaKavayt Sham. When we experienced the giving of the Torah on Mount Sinai, we also had the same concept, where Hashem rested his Shekhinah, came down and revealed himself. And we know that the Jewish people were not allowed to approach the mountain, right? Only Moshe. But the Jewish people had borders. They were like, don't go further than here, otherwise you would die, it said, right? The same thing with the Mishkan, it says. He says, as when the mountain had Hashem's honor, it says over there very carefully, Vitziva, and it commanded, V'hazar ha-karev yumas. That's the extent, that a stranger who comes close will die. Kasher amar sham. That's what it says by the Mishkan, just like it says by Har Sinai, Kisokol yisokol, that anybody who comes close will be stoned. So just like by the Har Sinai, they were very careful not to come past a certain point. By the Mishkan, they are also given exact borders where they are permitted to go and where they are not. And then he gives other examples which are similar, the Mishkan to Har Sinai. V'tziva v'lo yavayu l'reis kiveles ha-kaydesh v'meisu, you shouldn't come when things are uncovered into the Mishkan. We know that only certain kahanim and Leviim were permitted to go when they needed to dismantle the Mishkan, but regular people were not allowed, and even the Leviim couldn't look at certain things, only certain families, otherwise you would die. Kasher hizr sham, just like by Har Sinai, what does it say? Pen yehersu el Hashem lirais, if you will break the boundaries and you will come close and see God, the parts that you're not permitted to see, well, terrible consequences will happen. V'tzivo shmartem es mishmeres ha-kodesh. Also here we're commanded to guard the holiness, ves mishmeres ha-mizbeach, and the holiness of the mizbeach, of the altar. Just like Hasher Omer Shem, just like by Har Sinai. V'gam ha-kayhanim ha-nigashim el Hashem, the kayhanim who come close to Hashem, they had to sanctify, yiskatru, they had to sanctify themselves. And that's why it said over there, v'ha-kayanim, v'ha-am, right, that the kayanim and the nation all had to go through processes of sanctity, we know, before the giving of the Torah. And that's the first part. Then he says, v'hine tziva eichtia mishmeres ha-mishkan. Then it goes on to tell us exactly how we will guard and how we will keep the Mishkan and all of the vessels. V'eichyachanu, how we will camp saviv around it. V'yamayit ha'amei rochek, and the nation will stand from a distance. We know a very interesting thing, that just like by Har Sinai, there were borders and different members were able to go closer. So Moshe went the closest, and then Aaron, and then Yeshua, and then the rest of the Jewish people, right? And then this Canaan, and then the rest of the Jewish people. Also by the Mishkan, we had the Mishkan in the middle. Around it is what we call Machane Leviya, the camp of the Levites. And around it was the camp of the rest of Bnei Yisrael. We'll see that more in detail next week. And then we go on and we say, what happened? Eich yisnagu boi b'chan noisai, right? How we act when it's camped, when it's actually resting. U'b'seisai, when we carry it. U'mayasu b'mishmartai, exactly what each member of the tribe of Levi would do during their time. In other words, everybody had a shift. So what they had to do during their shift. V'hakol maile l'mikdash v'kavayt lai. Why do we go into such detail? Because it shows us the great honor, the greatness, the superiority of the Mishkan, of Hashem's dwelling amongst the Jewish people. And we say a beautiful thing, K'maisha Amru Zal, just like the Chazal say, Einoi doime palterin shel melech. We're on the top of the second column. You cannot compare a palace of the king, Sheyesh lai shaymin, that has guards, lepalterin she'ein lai shaymin, to a palace which has no guards. V'ha-sefer, and that's why we had the Levites very specifically camping and always being around the Mishkan to give honor to the Mishkan and later on to the Beis HaMikdash as well. And then the Ramban says, V'ha-sefer hazeh kulay b'mitzvah shah. This sefer, Bamidbar, is really almost entirely things which have to do with the time, which means it's not dealing with things which are eternal, it's more things which happened in that generation, the time when they were traveling through the desert until they reached the land of Israel. Shenitzdavu bahem ba'amdam bamidbar, which was commanded while they were in the desert. Ubin Nisim, and a very important part is the miracles, Hanasim Lahem, that were done for them. Why? Why do we have to know it if it happened in the past and it doesn't happen now? So obviously it does happen now. It happens now on a different level. But we have to look a little more carefully. So he says like this, a very beautiful thing. First of all, the Sipur, he says, L'saper kol ma'isa Hashem, to tell us all of the actions of Hashem, asher asa imahem, that Hashem did for the Jewish people, lahafli, as a wonder. And we should wonder, and we should say, wow, we should be with our mouths open. We should say, look at how much love, look at how much kindness Hashem treated the Jewish people as they were traveling through the desert. And in a minute, we'll see what that gives us and what we should live with is every day when we wake up, even when we feel like we're in a desert, we shouldn't feel alone. Hashem is with us and He travels with us in our personal deserts. That's what He says. So He says like this, V'tziva, and then He continues, V'siper ki hachal asay say ve'em lifneim, Hashem began to give their enemies before them, lacheref, to the sword. V'tziva eich techelak ha'aretz lam, how He's going to divide the land. The ein b'sefer hazeh mitzvahs nehagas l'dayris. This sefer doesn't really have mitzvahs which we conduct, which are kept through the generations. Zulasi k'tzas mitzvahs ben yonei akarbonis, except for a few mitzvahs which have to do with certain sacrifices, which shehischil bahem b'sefer akayan, and which were already began in Vayikra. Hashem already began to tell about them, and then He finishes in this sefer, v'loy neshlam b'yurin, it wasn't complete, their explanation, sham there, v'hishliman b'sefer hazeh, and He continues and He completes them in this sefer. So this is a very general introduction. Ramban tells us what we're about to embark on in our sefer. But just to take a little pause before we go into a few other commentaries, I'll just tell you a few very interesting things. So first of all, if we just stop for a moment and think about it, it is a little bit challenging for us because we know that the Chumash is really an eternal book. It's not Stam, it's Hashem's, you know, it's Hashem invested Himself. And we say that everything in Chumash is not temporary, right? It's not just for one time, it's for us. Everything's relevant for us, for, not just as a general nation, but to each and every one of us as individuals and all of our lives. So it makes it a little bit harder for us to understand why we have to be given all the details of Chumash Bamidbar if it's really about things that happened so many thousands of years ago to the Jewish people as they're traveling through the desert and it doesn't repeat itself. If we think about it, the Mishkan was something which never repeated itself, even though later we had a Beis HaMikdash, which is similar. But the Mishkan, the fact that it could be put up and taken down and put up and taken down, that never happened again. We didn't have that. We didn't go through the desert and go, thank God, all their experiences that they did. But we find, if we think about it, this is a very, very, one of the most, I mean, every Pasuk and Chumash, every word, every letter is exact and very significant. But what we find really, and that's in a sense almost the Ramban is hinting and other Mefarshim tell us, is that we really have to reflect, first of all, that this is the concept of a midbar, a desert. In a minute I'll tell you what's so important about a desert. But if you think about it, if you put in context the story of this, this really, this whole Chumash, in a sense, shouldn't really have happened. What do I mean? What should have happened was just our Parsha, where they're counted, and then they're set up, and then they should have gone straight into the land of Israel, right? That's what was supposed to happen. Instead, they messed up. They did the sin, and that's what we'll get to next year, Mirtz Hashem, the sin of the spies, right? The Meraglim. So Moshe Rabbeinu, Hashem says you have to stay 40 years in the desert, and that's all the stories that were told in this Chumash. So in a certain sense, this Chumash is really has a very negative connotation, because it's like a punishment. It's because you didn't do what you were supposed to, so you didn't go into Eretz Yisrael, so you spent 40 years wandering and all these different things happen to you. So on one hand it's like a very negative, and that's also what a desert seems to feel. It's a place of desolation, things don't grow, there's no water, snakes and scorpions, the climate is extreme. It's not a place where people live. So a desert is a very strange thing, and that's the name of the whole Chumash. That's on the one hand. But then at the same time, on the other hand, we know that, and we'll see in a second, that desert is a very, very specific thing. And we understand that the Torah was only given, Hashem chose a desert, right? Midbar Sinai. Never mind that they spent 40 years traveling in the desert, even before they were sentenced to travel in the desert for 40 years. Hashem chose a desert to give the Torah. So obviously a desert has something very unique and very special where we can grow in a way where we can't grow somewhere else. And what happens if you think about just on a simple level, they spent 40 years where they had the mun. I mean, what could be more beautiful than that? They didn't have to do any planting, any farming, didn't have to worry about the rain, didn't have to work hard in the field, which meant that they had time to learn Torah day and night. From who? From the best teachers possible, Moshe and Aaron. You couldn't get better teachers. Why? Because they spent 40 years in the desert. They had the clouds of glory around them, the water of Miriam. They had Miriam HaNeviah there. They were just like almost in heaven. So it's an interesting thing. It has a dual kind of thing. On the one hand, it seems quite negative and harsh. And on the other hand, it's such an uplifting and such a spiritual journey. And that's the truth is, and many miracles, as the Ramban just said, they experienced many miracles and they saw how Hashem protected them the entire time. Never mind miracles, but every moment was a miracle. Because we know that what it says about the clouds of glory, that it like flattened the desert. And there was no hills. They had such an easy walk, as we say. There was no extreme weather. Everything was fantastic for them. So the miracles they lived with were incredible. So it's a very fascinating thing. It's two at once, two opposite things. And the truth is, this is our life. Our life has many challenges. We don't need to enumerate them, unfortunately. We don't have to stop and think too hard. The challenges we know about. And even that's on a personal level and on a general level, unfortunately, many challenges. Today was another tragedy in Israel. It doesn't stop, right? It doesn't stop. They don't let us alone, the Arabs. They don't, nothing. It's constant, constant, constant. So we live in a desert in the sense where it's snakes and it's scorpions and it's desolate and there's no water. And yet at the same time, we're aware that as we said right away, Se'u es Reish, that Hashem counts us, He loves us, He lifts us, He's there with us, He travels with us. And it's only in the desert, it's only during this time that we are able to grow and come closer to Hashem and have the revelation of the Mishkan as we had there. It's only in a desert that we are able to have that. So it's quite an amazing thing. It's as we see the journey through the desert is modeled on the experience of Har Sinai. That's it, exactly, no other distraction. But sometimes I feel like we have too many distractions. But Rona, that's what we want, I know. But the idea is, I guess, that we can choose. So we choose which mode we live in, so to speak. That's what we choose. And that's why the idea, as we say, with the concept of the way the way they had it at Har Sinai, so it says a beautiful thing that the Jewish people camped around the mountain, and it says actually that it was almost, they were modeled like the angels around Hashem. That's what it was. It was such a high kind of formation, and that's what they had here in the desert as well. So they live, it's a very dual life, but it's our choice. It's what we choose, so to speak, to concentrate on. And this is in a very big nutshell. But now I want to just share, just before we go into more Mefarshim, which we might end up doing next week, but I want to share a very few beautiful ideas that I saw specifically about the desert. You know, because we said the desert, that's what the whole Chumash is called. It's called Chumash Bamidbar. And this is where they're having this incredible growth. What does the desert represent? So let's see. He says like this. First of all, why in the desert? So there's many reasons that we say that Hashem, first of all, chose to give us the Torah in the desert. And obviously also that's why they had to go and travel through the desert for so many years. You know, I'll just stop the share for a minute just to, so we could see. Let me see. Okay, even though you can't. So I'm just going to share a few beautiful ideas. So we say like this. First of all, we have a very beautiful concept. Some of these are very famous, but some are quite deep and beautiful. It says like this, that if the Torah was given in the land, so many people ask a question, why in the desert? Don't you think the Torah should have been given in Israel? Israel, the holiest country in the world. Doesn't that make sense? That Hashem should have just somehow taken them, boom, from Egypt straight into Israel and given them the Torah there. So it says a very magnificent thing. If the Torah would have been given in the land of Israel, then the people who live in Israel would have had a special claim to the Torah. And they would have said, and they would have thought, and we would have all thought, and it would have been in a way almost right, that the Torah can only be learned in the land of Israel. But now that the Torah was given in the desert, it shows us that the Torah is for anybody. for anybody wherever they live in the world, even in a desert, so to speak, which is the least inhabited place, the opposite of Israel, right, as we say, in a sense, even spiritually, right? So that's one thing. So it's equal, belongs to every Jew equally. The other thing we say, the very famous thing, is that just like a desert is hefker, a desert is a place which is called ownerless, hefker. Nobody can claim, nobody buys land in the desert. The desert is ownerless. And this is the idea of Torah. Not only is Torah ownerless, but even more, we have to make ourselves ownerless. If we declare ourselves hefker, then we are able to accept and absorb Torah. Now, what does that mean that we make ourselves ownerless? Obviously, we're not ownerless. We are owned. But who are we owned by? Only Hashem. So the idea is that we make ourselves owned by nobody except for Hashem. Now we think, oh, we're all free people. Of course we're not owned by anybody. But then when we take a little step back and be honest with ourselves, do we not take into account a lot of times everything that somebody else will say, how somebody else will look, what somebody else will think, and many of our decisions are made based on that. Are we truly ownerless, or are we owned by the opinions of other people or general society norms or whatever it may be, or even our own idea of what we think our life should be? That's not a way for Torah. Torah, only Hashem. He's the only one. He owns the world and nobody else. So therefore, in order for us to absorb Torah, we have to have that. So now there's another thing also about ownerless. Ownerless also shows humility. That's what we know, the famous thing, that the Torah is only given to somebody who feels a very deep humility. Now, what's the concept of humility? So that has to be broken up, because there's a very fascinating thing. It says like this, that a wilderness is a place that anybody can walk through. So a Jew also has to be humble. But what does that mean, humble? So we say, first of all, because there's many, many important things. Because a person has to look, if you want to grow in Torah, you have to always keep company with people who know a little bit more than you. Now, the truth is, what does that mean? If you're humble, then everybody can teach you something. So what will happen is that you will constantly be in that mode that you will be learning, you will be growing. A person who's not humble doesn't feel they need to learn from other people, and is also more selective who they learn from, and therefore will only be very limited in accepting things. So that's already going to be a blockage right away. Also, somebody who's going to have a sense of superiority will pick and choose which mitzvahs he feels good about and which mitzvahs don't talk to him, because he feels a very strong sense of self. So he says, well, it doesn't gel with me. But if you're humble, it doesn't have to gel with you. You don't count, in a sense. It's more what Hashem is asking you to do. So that's why it's a very important prerequisite for Torah. Another thing also, it says very beautifully, that Hashem is pleased with a humble person. What does that mean? Because what is one of the biggest traits of a humble person? A humble person doesn't always excuse themselves when they make mistakes. A humble person is somebody who, let's say, before they go to sleep at night is the best time to do it, looks back and says, maybe I shouldn't have said that. Maybe I shouldn't have gone there. Maybe I shouldn't have looked at that person that way. Maybe I should have acted a certain different way. And actually will try to grow. That's a humble person. Somebody who's not humble will never, ever take stock properly. They're never going to find self-criticism. And anybody who criticizes them, God forbid, right away, they're put up big blocks. You know, God forbid, they can't take any criticism. But somebody who's humble can take a positive criticism because they want to grow. So they want to be pointed out. I heard such a magnificent thing. Dr. Pelkowitz shared a very fascinating thing. And of course, I don't have the exact details, but he shared it was a scientific study of somebody who studied, I think it was neurosurgeons, top neurosurgeons. And he did a study, it was a psychologist who did a study to see what was the mark of success. In other words, what made certain, let's say he took a bunch, let's say 100, what made the top five become the top five neurosurgeons, and what made the bottom ones, who had to end up being disqualified from being surgeons, even after all their years of study, what was the key to success and what was the key to failure? So obviously they studied many things, so you would think perhaps intelligence, good hands, because it's a surgeon, right? Somebody who has a good eye, somebody who went to good schools, had good teachers, got good marks. He said none of those things. The one key, which was incredible, that marked the difference between success and failure was one thing. It was the ones who were able to take criticism, and then when they got criticized, so for example, if God forbid they made a mistake, which we know, you don't want any neurosurgeon to make a mistake, but they made a mistake, what would happen? So they studied. So the ones who were successful after, if they made a mistake, they would immediately say, what did I do wrong? Go to the, ask 100 other neurosurgeons, perhaps to go through the procedure with them. What could I have done differently? How could I have done it differently? Analyze every single detail and constantly, obviously, learn from their mistakes. Now, the bottom ones, fascinating, he says. What happened with them? Let's say they made a mistake. Immediately, if you would have had this team with you, you would have also made the same mistake. What's wrong with the lighting? What's wrong with the instruments? They were damaged today. In other words, they always found an excuse, something else that was causing what their mistake was. Those people at the end were disqualified. They weren't even able to become neurosurgeons, as he said, or they didn't stay neurosurgeons for very long. This, as we can see, Taira tells us already, right? The scientific study is good because it shows it to us in clear words. But Taira says right away, Bamidbar, that's the key. The only way for us to become truly one with Torah, and we know one with Torah means people who identify as a Torah Jew, means somebody who's constantly growing, coming closer to Hashem, is a person who is humble, who is willing to accept criticism and to look and reflect and say, I've made a mistake, how can I grow? What can I do better next time? So it's a very big key. This is the biggest key. Another interesting thing it says, general benefits of humility, and this is a big thing, is that, and this is a fascinating thing, that humility is very much associated with joy. So many times we say humility is associated with gratitude, which it is, because a person who has humility doesn't have high expectations, right? It's not in a sense of entitlement. I'm entitled to this, and the other, and therefore they're satisfied, and therefore they're grateful for everything they have. But the real result of that is that they're constantly in a state of joy, because every small thing that somebody does for them or every small thing that they experience is massive to them, because they don't expect more. So they're able to feel the joy of the moment and the joy of the small things. And as we know, one of the big things of Torah is joy. You can't have Torah without Simcha. Simcha goes together. So that's the concept. We wouldn't necessarily associate a midbar, a desert, with joy, but we see that it is very connected, because it's directly connected to this concept of humility. Another thing also, if misfortune befalls a person who's not humble, they get very resentful, they get very angry, and we know they become very bitter. And bitterness is one of the worst things. A person who's bitter and angry at life and angry at the world, and that person is resistant to anything, to any wisdom, to any accumulation, and to any connection to Hashem. So that's another thing. And also, a beautiful thing it says, that a humble person makes friends. It's very beautiful. The Medrash tells us, obviously, why? Because a humble person easily forgives others. So therefore, they're easygoing. So the relationships thrive. They don't lose friends. What's the idea of friends? We know that in Torah, the only way for us to grow, we say, Aseh lecha rav, make for yourself a teacher, uknei lecha chaver, and acquire a friend. The idea being that we grow through our friends. We know that a true friend is somebody who's A, going to help give us the confidence when we need it, be there like our back when we need it, but also point out sometimes when we need to hear something not so 100%. So that we have that's the way we grow, and that's only through humility. Another thing it says, now putting humility aside, what's the idea of a desert? Another thing of a desert, which is extremely key to Torah, as we say, this is the whole name of the whole Chumash, Bamidbar, is the concept of a Jew has to be ready to sacrifice. I know that's not a nice way to, nowadays, not very acceptable, but A Jew has to be ready to sacrifice for Torah. A person who thinks they're going to live life in the, so to speak, what we mean by luxury is not necessarily that we should have to give up material comforts if we have them, but if a person lives their life and that's their whole purpose, and that becomes their whole focus, there's no way that they're going to grow in Torah. Because just on a simple level, we know. Let's say, for example, for a person, they have to get up earlier to daven, right? You have to wake up earlier, so you're going to give up on your sleep. A person who wants to keep kosher, it costs more money. A person who wants to keep Shabbos, they're not going to work on Shabbos. So it's again going to cost them. Expenses of Shabbos, the food cost, you know, everything. Being a Torah Jew, as we mentioned earlier, is not something easy. It's hard. It demands sacrifice. And therefore, we have to be ready to be a midbar and to sacrifice. Otherwise, Torah will not be part of our life. Another thing, a very beautiful one, similar to what we mentioned last week. Last week we said with the Chukaisa at the end, we said the person has to be have a sort of that you also tied into a concept of humility, but more of a yearning. So it says like this, that just like a desert is empty, we know that nothing grows there. So a person, no matter how much Torah they learn, should never feel like they have a full garden. They should always feel that they are empty in the sense where they need to fill themselves up with more Torah. You have to always be thirsty, like a desert, like needing more and more and more and more, and not sit down and say, wow, look how much I've learned already, fantastic, I've gotten, I can close the book, it's all done. Never feel that way. And that's another important thing of a desert. Another interesting thing it says is that a person, a Jew, has to have an intellect desert-like, it says. What does that mean, desert-like? So just like the desert is free, so to speak, of foreign elements, which means a very interesting thing. What we mean by that is that it's not really free of foreign elements, but it's free of many elements. It's sort of empty. So very fascinating that in order for us to understand Torah properly, sometimes we have to free our mind from the way, the perspectives that it had until now. Because until now, sometimes we have perspectives which are very secular, very Western. And in order for us to absorb Torah and to accept it, we have to retrain our mind to think in a Torah way. And that's the concept of a desert. So that's part of the process by which we accept. I'll just share one or two more beautiful things. It says like this, that very nice thing. Also, why Hashem daf, there's one more thing about the desert. It says a beautiful thing that also the Medrash gives a very big detail and actually brings a very beautiful thing. It says like this, that when Hashem was giving the Torah, so he gives an analogy to a king who actually conquered a new country. And now he wants the people to know him and he wants the people to accept him as the leader. So he decides he's going to go visit the big cities. So he comes to the first big city and he's hoping for a lot of people to come out to greet him. And what does he find? Everybody's shuttered up in their homes. Nobody's interested to see him. He goes to another big city and the same thing happens. And an advisor explains to him why. He's gone to the big cities where people are affluent. The people there don't want to see the new king. They're afraid. Why? Because they're afraid that he's going to impose new taxes. He's going to impose new laws on how they should run their business. He's going to make new hours. He's going to do all kinds of things. They're not interested. So he decides to visit a poor country town. When he goes to the poor country town, all the people come out to greet him. Why? Because they have nothing to lose, only to gain by a new leader. And it says when Hashem came time for Hashem to give the Torah. So first it says a beautiful thing. Hashem went into the sea. He approached the Red Sea. And what does the Red Sea do? You know, we say in Hallel, Hayom Ra'a Vayonis. The sea saw and it fled. The sea runs away from Hashem. And then the mountains, the great, you know, mountains, they also, Haharim Tirkaducha Elim, right? The mountains, they jump like a ram. They're not interested. They're afraid. What's Hashem going to impose on them? So what does Hashem do? He goes to the Midbar. And the desert accepts Hashem, as we say, because it's a clean slate. There's nothing there for them to lose. It's only to gain. And this is the attitude that we have. And this is where Hashem chose to give the Torah. Now, there was just one more I wanted to share. Let me just see something. Okay. Let's see some of these things. Okay. Okay. So, and then, time is up. Okay. So next week in Mirza, I'm sorry, I know it took a long time. It's a very big introduction, but next week we'll see a lot more in depth, actually, very beautifully, specifically about the words of the first Pasuk, as well as the concept, as we said, of the counting itself and what it means to us, and also how we live with this in our daily life, so to speak, in a sense, as we're saying, to incorporate, because this is about us, as we say, noticing, yes, we're in a desert, and it isn't dark, not dark, but it's a place of desolation, of thirst, and yet it's a place of Hashem's presence and the revelation of Hashem's presence, and this is really our life. So next week we'll see a little bit more. I just want to make where you can unmute yourself. One second. Yeah, okay. So I think you guys can unmute yourself. Okay.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Have a very good week.